Thank you for downloading this podcast from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. This evening lecture has been sponsored by the Marilyn and Siggy Zichrono Livracha Zering Omer Pardes Program. To download other podcasts and for other digital content, please visit us at lmod.pardes.org.
I'm Leon Morris. I'm the president of Pardes, and it's such an honor this evening to engage in conversation. My friend Ruby Namdar. Ruby is known to many of you. He was born and raised here in Yerushalayim. His first book, a novella of five stories called Chaviv, won the published in the year 2000, won the Ministry of Culture Award for the best first publication. And tonight's program is an extension of his award-winning novel, The Ruined House, which was published as Habayit Asher Necharav in Hebrew in 2013 and won the Sapir Prize, Israel's most prestigious literary award. Won that award in 2014. And then, maybe we'll talk about this, they changed the rules that you can't be living in Chutz La'aretz. So you were responsible for a rule change.
I'm often blamed, yes.
It was translated into English in 2017 by Hillel Halkin. The New York Times, in its review, called The Ruined House, a masterpiece of modern religious literature. And I think it truly is. I had the privilege to work with Ruby in New York in adult education. We were introduced by mutual friends, and there at what was then called the Skirball Center, Ruby taught biblical and Talmudic narrative, as he does in many places. And I'm just so excited that you're here, and what a beautiful context for a reunion.
Thank you. I'm excited, too. And I just want to say what I said to you and I said to everyone, that Pardes has a very special place in my life because I met my wife, Carolyn, when she was studying at Pardes. And she lived in Jerusalem. And then we had a long, crazy, romantic saga. And then 7 years later, because all the numbers have to be biblical, we reunited in New York. And that's the end of history, you know, from there.
Everything is
so good. In a way, Pardes is implicated in the change of rules because you ended up there because of her. And
Do with it what you may. You know,
so I was deeply drawn to this novel, as I imagine many of you were. And I'm really in awe, I mentioned this to you a few minutes ago, of your creativity and your imagination. There's such depth and subtlety, and it's brilliant. It's a brilliant novel on so many levels. But I'm chiefly interested in the way in which you take up the symbols and the references of Korbanot, the sacrificial system, and the Beit HaMikdash, the temple, which are the most difficult and the most perplexing part of Judaism for contemporary Jews. And so to me, your novel demonstrates the creative and imaginative power of these texts, of this vocabulary. It resonates, I think, for us as an institution, because we're all about finding contemporary meaning in even the most difficult ancient texts. And I think for this reason alone, we could say Dayenu.
Thank you.
So before we delve into the themes and your treatment of sacrifice and temple, I wanted to ask you to describe briefly, I think you could do a better job than I could, for those who might not have read the novel, the plot and the subplot of the novel.
So thank you, first of all. Thank you very much. Generous reading. The Ruined House follows a year in the life of Professor Andrew Cohen, who is a very elegant, successful, powerful man living in New York, and who's kind of a caricature of the New York success story. You know, he publishes in all the right places and sits on the right boards. He has His dinner party has a regal reputation. He is very urbane, very suave. He's happily divorced, as in, like, he gets, you know, all the bliss of domestic life minus the commitment. He dates a woman half his years. It's like a, think of a Woody Allen type, and that's, I'm not using it as an accent because Woody Allen is mentioned in the novel, and there's a bit of a tribute to that. So into this framework of the kind of cliche New York success story that we enter, something completely different is introduced. As the plot proceeds, something happens to the life and mind of Professor Cohen. It begins to unravel. All the structures of his life and mind begin to unravel. And as this happens, and we don't know what's the cause here and what's the effect, he begins to see visions. Visions of an ancient ritual, of an ancient shrine. Something that seems vaguely familiar but mostly alien. Sometimes very beautiful, attractive, alluring. Sometimes scary, very scary. Sometimes even disgusting. These visions become stronger and stronger. He begins to see visions of the Holy Temple in Jerusalem, but he has no tools, intellectual or emotional, to deal, to process what it is that he sees and why he sees it. In the beginning, Andrew does exactly what every normal person in his situation would do, is denial, a healthy survival mechanism of the mind. So he's in denial, he's like brushes it aside, as it becomes harder and harder, and the efforts to be in denial become more and more desperate. We follow until the end, which I'm not going to tell you what happens. There's a second plot in the novel, and I used to call it the subplot, but then I stopped because we don't know what's the real plot and what's the... So let's just call it the second plot. Maybe we want to open the page, sure, and show them the... The second plot is not told or arranged on the page like a modern literary text. It's told and arranged on the page in a manner that is evocative of a Talmudic page. And actually, HarperCollins in America did even a better job than my Hebrew publisher. So in some ways, these pages are better. You can read more. They're richer in material. They look more like the Vilna Shas. They actually are much better than the Hebrew. So the little ironies of life. And in this plot, we follow a drama, unspoken drama, hardly a word is spoken there, that happens in the temple, in the second temple, one Yom Kippur, one day of atonement, between the high priest and a junior priest that is assigned to assist him. And this drama happens there, and it happens mostly in the mind of the junior priest. It's mostly a drama of actions and suspicions and thoughts. And you may know of the very precise, pre-described order of the ritual, Seder Avodah, of Yom HaKippurim, of the Day of Atonement, that was the pinnacle of religious life in ancient Israel, and included a lot of blood, a lot of fire, a lot of incense. And it around this story, there's a halo of commentary. Unlike the real Talmudic page, the centerpiece is fiction and modern, and the texts that hover around it are actually the ancient Talmudic, Midrashic, biblical texts. And also at the bottom of some pages, there are excerpts from a Talmudic, a fascinating Kabbalistic text called Sefer Shaar HaGilgulim by Rabbi Chaim Vital, the disciples of the Ari, of Rabbi Isaac Luria. And in these pages, Rabbi Luria discusses his visions and ideas about reincarnation and the rebirth of the soul. And in these small print, there might be a hermeneutic, a interpretative cipher that could help us understand what happened to Professor Cohen in New York of the year 2000. So this is the summary of the book.
Ruby, what drew you to open up for you and for us the language and imagery of the temple and sacrifices?
Look, there is a conscious and there is an unconscious explanation. I must say that when this idea was born in my head, and many ideas are born in the head of authors, and I would say 98% of them are aborted at some point. Hmm. This one persisted and persisted and almost forced itself on me. And it was supposed to be a short story, then it's supposed to be a novella. Hmm. Look at it now. Then I worked on it for 10 years and it almost dragged me to the abyss. It was very hard. It was 100% clear to me from the moment I dreamt up this story, this novel, that it must be the temple. It must be the ancient, almost reptilian memory of our religion, the deep, the sacrifices are even before the temple. Hmm. You know, this kind of deep, shamanic, earthy, bloody essence of what has then become this marvelous whirlwind of words that we call Judaism today. That's a vortex of words. But if you go into the depth of the vortex, something causes it. And this is the shamanic past of our religion, the core, the unconscious, if you will. And then consciously, I was really looking for how can I create maximum tension? How can I feel that as an artist, my job is not to bridge or explain. And artists who try to serve as bridges or explain bore me, and I don't really think very highly of them. I hope nobody is going to be offended now. I feel like my job is not to... That's educators. We have very good educators. And then, you know, as an artist, I have to take the collective imagination to almost reckless distances, not to worry about the... And I was looking to create maximum tension between Andrew Cohen's mind, which is in some way the Jewish everyman of today, you know, the secular, liberal, very cosmopolitan, very smart, very sophisticated secular mind, and between the deepest, most alluring but dangerous place of our collective mind. I wanted to create this endless tension between the two poles of existence, and then I wanted this tension to explode and not to be resolved. Mm. This is the gesture I was looking for. I was not looking to resolve the tension. I was looking to create the tension and let it be there, an endless explosion of tension. And that is, again, I could not have not done it with the temple. Even though I personally, you know, I'm not one of the temple people. You know, I don't, my politics or the sociological group I was raised, I mean, I was not part of like the temple movement. People who are actually thinking, dreaming, recently acting, to recreate the actual thing rather than the memory of it or the... So this is my short answer. Yeah.
In a relatively new reform High Holiday Machzor, the metaphor that's used to try to prepare liberal American Jews for entering into a part of the liturgy, the mm-hmm. Seder HaAvodah, the Avodah service of Yom Kippur, the metaphor that's used to ease them into it, I want to try this metaphor out on you, is the temple and sacrifice as a precious family heirloom. treasure them, you preserve them. Is that a useful metaphor for you, a family heirloom? And if not, what metaphor
you
would
know,
you prefer?
I think a beautiful family heirloom is not a bad way of putting it. Mm-hmm. I think that it's better than expunging it mm-hmm. from liturgy, as was done for many generations by the same denomination you mentioned. And it's better than constantly being ashamed of it, apologetic for it, having to feel that you're in conflict with it. So I think that's a gateway. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's not a... It's a gateway. Mm-hmm. The only thing that it's a... Let's just say it's a family heirloom that was in an explosion, in a nuclear explosion area, and it's full of radiation. So it's not an innocent family heirloom. Mm. It is a very
it's
potent.
Dangerous.
Yes. It's powerful. Very powerful. Mm. It's like in those horror movies where the cute little toy gets up at night. It's a dangerous, potent symbol. It is. Because it really connects us to a certain part of our mind that is very free and very unbound, you know, by the restrictions, the mind restrictions of liberalism, modernity. One can reenact the symbol of the temple as a wonderful humanistic symbol. The temple, you know, was not meant for the Jewish people only. The temple was conceived in ancient Israel as a universal house of prayer. A lot of people from outside the religion would travel to the temple.
One of the wonders of the world.
Yes, and would bring offerings that would be accepted. Non-Jews brought offerings to the temple in Jerusalem, and the offerings were accepted and offered. When the temple was destroyed, one of the rabbis, you're a Talmid Chacham, so you should remind me, I forget who it was. He said, if the nations of the world only knew what the temple was, they would never have destroyed it. The temple was not only atoning for Israel, it was atoning for all of humanity. Why on earth would they want to ruin the house that atoned for them? So there is these sides of it, but it's also a very demanding. And look what's happening now, the birth of this new movement in Jerusalem, and we're close to the, where people are becoming less and less satisfied with this kind of making the temple into a beautiful object that's sitting on your Judaica
shelf.
And you smell it sometimes and look at it, and it's beautiful. It just you adorn yourself with. They don't want it like this. So it's a potent, very potent symbol. That's why I was so drawn to writing about it.
And you weren't worried about emboldening those forces that you're mentioning. That's not your role.
It's not my role. I'm look, artists. We should be nihilists. I'm not a nihilist, but there is something nihilistic about art. We are not, and if there isn't, it's a problematic art. Mm-hmm. There should be a certain freedom that does not let the bounds, how do you call it in English, the tethers of social responsibility. A cultural responsibility to kind of bind you. I honestly didn't even realize that this book will be discovered by these people and that they will be very excited by it. And it's funny because the book is everything but orthodox, everything but a prudish. It is not the book that I would expect the religious right, extreme religious right in Israel to embrace. It's not necessarily a Zionist work. It's a work that takes religious epiphany and plants it on the banks of the Hudson rather than in Jerusalem. The main protagonist marries a sheksa and is totally happy about it. It's not. Something is happening to the mic, or am I?
Switch mics with you.
So I was. Sorry. Should I just shout? Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much. I was surprised by this warm embrace. Also, I left Israel before the religious right gained so much power. So and cultural power as well. I didn't really know it. It was pretty marginal when I left 20 years ago. In those 20 years, the religious right in Israel gained a lot of power, but also really became a more full partner in the cultural discourse. And I wasn't really aware of that so much. It wasn't. It was excluded from the cultural discourse before that. So for me, I have to say that there was a strange but exciting discovery, to discover the intelligentsia of the religious right. I found people contacted me because of the book. The book, the first newspaper to write about the novel was Makor Rishon, which did a marvelous job, loved it, wrote very, very, beyond anyone wildest dreams review, a few reviews, a big interview with me. I started getting a lot of correspondence from authors and thinkers from the religious right in Israel. And I found myself engaged in a very, very deep and lush conversation with people with whom my politics differ greatly, but culturally I feel very close to them, very, very close to them. So there are many surprises, you know, of I call it the secret life of books. You never know what the book is going to do and what it does when you're sleeping.
Ruby, what does a rapprochement with the language and symbols of sacrifice have to offer contemporary Jews? In other words, what are we missing in our Jewish lives that the sacrificial system or an engagement with it can give us?
Without it being interpreted like I am saying that we should all leave the books and go kill sheep, although I think we should think about Korban Pesach as a possible something. Without it, I want it to be clear. I am not part of the Tnuat HaMikdash, and I'm not here to start the sacrifices. Also, we can't because we need the red heifer, which the evangelists and the South are raising right now, genetically modifying, so it might be a... You know that, right? Good. In Jerusalem, people know it. In New York, it shocks people. I think that there's a lot of beauty and power in this idea of sacrifice. And I would like to speak about it for a minute, because I think even speaking about it is already a way to connect to it. The sacrifices were not gruesome. It is not, if what's really gruesome is the way we eat meat today. Mm-hmm. That's terrible. And this is a carnivore speaking. That's terrible. That's inhumane. That's unhealthy for us, terrible for the animals, terrible for the planet, soulless, heartless. The sacrifices in themselves are actually a way to connect to nature, connect to the land, connect heaven and earth, feed yourself, feed your family, feed the poor, and bring back a certain cosmic balance to the world. Okay? And everybody loves to talk about the myth about Native Americans who would they're often used as an example of nations that knew how to be part of the cycle of nature. They would eat meat, they would apologize to the meat before. It's a very beloved symbol in New Age food culture.
It's the kind of Orientalism of...
And the sacrifices are as beautiful, if not more. And we just need to understand that. in a world where people hardly ate meat. It was not something you ate every day, not every week. The eating of meat is a very festive thing. It's rare and it's festive. So it is done in a way that shows gratefulness. Yes. It shows responsibility. And the responsibility is not just because you feed the whole community, people who would never dream of having a bite of protein, you know. But also because we spill the blood to the ground. We don't eat the blood. Why? Because there's a big economy, invisible economy of blood. If you read the Bible, the economy of blood is a fascinating thing. Hadam hu ha-nefesh, the animal soul, the vital soul, nefesh, not neshama ruach, the vital soul, the lower but most basically important basis of our soul, is in the blood. And if you spill the blood of the animal back into the earth and don't consume. Eat it, don't consume it, ingest it, you then allow it to keep fertilizing the great cycle of life. I think it's a beautiful, beautiful way of thinking about food, nature, our responsibility for nature, our responsibility for society. And then there's the part that goes to heaven. Gratitude. Okay? You include the Creator in the feast of creation. Some parts of the meat and the animal go up to heaven. Aliyah lagavuha ola. So you're actually, by smoking the meat ola and the parts that are burnt, smoked on the altar, nothing is eaten, they are sent to heaven. So you basically unite heaven and earth in a festive meal of gratitude. Can anything be more beautiful than this? Another thing about this is that the act of sacrifice was also very beautifully choreographed. And this some people don't understand. The temple was the greatest spectacle in the world. And I want to... We have a minute about this?
Sure.
Look, we are used to a world in which there's mass production of not only materials, but images. We are bombarded with images. We see so much color and form and words and surfaces, and everything is so... our mind just has to protect itself.
This is the night after Eurovision, after
exactly.
all.
Exactly. Yes. In the ancient world, reality is very, very drab. Everything is homespun. Everything is very, very simple and coarse and colorless. When you enter a space like the temple and you see the most beautiful specimens of your own species, the priests were the most handsome men, dressed in the most beautiful materials in the world. There's no more beautiful materials. In the most beautiful building ever to have been built. That's how it is, the concept of it. And there are beautiful stories about how the temple looked, and it looks like the waves of the ocean are upon it. It's a great description. And the animals that are chosen for sacrifice are the most beautiful animals. You don't bring your, like, you know, they're majestic, beautiful animals. So this is a place where through this heightened aesthetics, actually humanity is celebrated. Humanity becomes divine. Right? You enter a place that looks like heaven. This is what heaven might look like. And then it infuses your life with meaning, with joy, it opens your imagination. It gives you a stairway to heaven, if you will. And this is something, again, we don't think about the temple so much. We just know that there's this thing and we're supposed to have a complex relationship with it. But if you just stop and read some of the most beautiful Talmudic texts written about the temple and stop to think about the values that sacrifice represented, for example, you will understand that they're much more relevant to our time, and we can totally understand them. We just need to take a minute and think about them and try to visualize this.
I want to, in this, I'm very moved by what you're sharing, and I want to kind of put into the mix a few additional contemporary takes on sacrifice and ask you to respond to it. Moshe Halbertal wrote, I think borrowing from the ideas of Marcel Mauss, of thinking about the sacrifice as a gift, right? The human desire to give something to God is so great. Richard Rubinstein wrote in the 1960s already as a post-Holocaust theologian how the sacrificial system allowed some kind of sublimation of the human impulse for violence into kind of a positive end. Jacob Milgram wrote about that whole complex ritual of Yom Kippur as a way in which human action could force God out of God's house. And so we needed one day a year to kind of clean the sanctuary of human sin that had become attached. I see your work as kind of a creative addition to some of those kinds of philosophical theories.
It's a good company to be in. Thank you. I think I'm mostly connected, I think, to what Moshe Halbertal said. But I think that, you see, it's so beautiful because you're basically describing a whole array of modern midrash. And this is the same thing that the Talmud did. I mean, the Talmud already treats the temple as a mythological thing of the past. And it's already engaged in this conversation. So it's all a game of memory, longing and fear from that very potent symbol.
Nostalgia, or would you say something?
You know, there's everything. There's nostalgia. There's longing, which is deeper and maybe more philosophical and more poetic than just simple nostalgia, although simple nostalgia is pretty poetic. There is also a certain alienation and distance that everybody's grappling with because it's so different than what we think about Judaism today. A lot of times there's just intellectual negligence. You just like, whatever, it was something of the past. You know, you don't, it's hard to sit and force yourself to seriously engage with something that is so dissimilar to what you think about Judaism today. You know, and especially if you don't speak Hebrew, it's much harder because, like, the tabernacle and it doesn't have the same, you know, resonance. It's a mishkan in Hebrew. So there's shechina and there's like, it's a more, but you say the tabernacle. It's like, what's a tabernacle? It doesn't, it's you know, it's like same phylacteries. It's like, what? it's yet another wall, you know, yet another wall. So I feel that we need poets and philosophers and sociologists and psychologists and authors and artists to help us connect to this symbol and see the beauty and relevance in it. All of what you have said resonates with me on, even if I don't necessarily agree with it, it resonates with me as a beautiful, honest and creative way of engaging this very important symbol.
And what about the communal aspect? Because we see everywhere, but particularly in America, a kind of hyper-individualism. Yeah. So here was this peak spiritual experience, which involved the whole nation.
Yeah, although, of course, this is very problematic. It involved a very, very certain elite of the nation as actors, and the rest are spectators. So it's a source of inspiration, but it's not everything about it is something that we can take today. we all accept the presence of elite in our life. When you want a heart surgery, you don't go to your neighbor, right? But why? I mean, we are all sources of... No, you want a surgeon. And if you want to have atonement, you go to a priest. If you want to go to... but still, we were told in post-enlightenment religion and by our great Rabbi Buber and others that we are all Kohen Gadol. We are all Moshe.
That's Anski's favorite line from the Dybbuk, right?
Yeah, yeah.
That, each person is a high priest,
yeah,
and every day is Yom Kippur,
yeah,
and every place is the Holy of Holies.
Yeah.
But you don't buy that.
And I think I do and I don't. Of course I do. I'm a Buber disciple like everybody else in the modern Jewish world. But at the same time, it is not so. Mm-hmm. There are people who are vessels that channel higher truths to humanity. There are. In various fields. So it's the communal element of the temple is inspiring and beautiful, but it does not reflect the way we think of community today. And that's, by the way, that's one more fence that stands between many contemporary Jews and the temple. Like the fact that even in our conservative synagogue in New York, they don't do Birkat Kohanim. They don't do Chan. Like, what? The most beautiful, moving... Well, first of all, they're Ashkenazim. What can you do? I mean, I don't know. They don't do it on Chag because, you know, we're all supposed to be equal before God. And like, but it's... yeah, but like it's look, if you want to engage on this level of seriousness, you have to ask these questions. I'm making fun of it. I'm poking fun at my own community. But it is a valid point. So these elements, yes, they're going to be alienating, and we will have to deal with this alienation and make decisions. But yes, there was a certain communal element in the way that Yom Kippur was not an individual atonement, but collective atonement. Mm-hmm. So you didn't stand there alone and saying, Aviti Chatati Pashati. You stood there as a collective, and you realized then, which in many ways, you know, it's very modern actually to realize, that the Hashgacha works in large, you know, it's about the nation. And some of the Hasidic rabbis much later tried to tell us, when you pray, don't make it only about yourself. Mm-hmm. Always make it about the collective, if you want it to have any power. Mm-hmm. It's interesting, right? That they, again, the modern Hasidic masters would say that to you. And this is a temple notion. Not even for the Jewish people. For the whole world you have to pray. Mm. Or it's not going to be useful. Mm. So in that way, I think there's a very beautiful communal message there.
In Josh Lambert's New York Times book review, he writes, in the ruined house, ancient Jewish holiness bleeds insistently, horrifically into the present. Oh. And I wondered, it's a beautiful line.
You should write novels. Right?
Holiness bleeds insistently, horrifically into the present. I'm wondering how memory functions, how you understand memory functioning in your novel. And how does it function for you? Is there such a thing as a Jewish collective memory as Andrew Cohen, your protagonist, experiences? And how does it present itself today?
Yes and no. Yes and no. There is, of course, a collective Jewish memory. There is, of course, a collective memory, period. I mean, we were not born with historical memory. What do we know? My dad said this. My first grade teacher said that. We only have our experience. But our life is so much bigger than our experience. If we only spoke about our experience, there would be no civilization. So we all, the most secular of secular amongst us, knows and works under the assumption that there is a collective mind. You don't have to be a mystic to believe in it. Mm-hmm. Only the Freudian myth is like, and even the Freudian myth doesn't really say that it all begins with the individual. Mm-hmm. But that you lie on the couch and it's all about you and it's all about your private first memories. But then Freud himself writes, you know, the father, the sons, the mother. I mean, who's the father? Who are the sons? I mean, he too goes to collective myth. Having said that, in this novel, I took the liberty to play with wilder ideas that are more Jungian in nature, that speak not only of a collective mind, which I really think everybody really knows, even if you don't think of it as that. You understand that there's a collective mind. But to think of a collective unconscious. And that is a very, I'm going to say this word in Bet Midrash, I hope I'm not going to be smitten. It's a very sexy kind of cool notion, and people love to play with it. But it's a very interesting and almost scary notion. What does it mean, a collective unconscious? So really, there are certain collectives that have certain inclinations that are more dangerous than others, that are smarter than others, that are more prone to this, that are more prone to that. It's a dangerous game, and Jung loved dangerous games, and I think people love to connect Nazism to Nietzsche, but I think Jungian philosophy has a lot, you know. It definitely did not... It didn't hurt fascist thinking, the fact that Jung went to this direction and took Freud's ideas to this depth. But I find this to be a very, very intriguing idea. Now, I don't necessarily believe in it in my rational mind every day. So I don't see you guys and say, oh, you remember I saw you in the 12th century by the... No. But the novel is a wonderful opportunity to explore these ideas and see how far we can get with them without committing to them as facts. You see? And that's really the place of these ideas in my life, is that I love to work with them as artistic notions. I would not personally commit to a positive saying that yes, there is such a thing as collective memory and there is such a thing as collective unconscious, and if you rub, you know, you scrape off a few layers of your mind, you will see, you know, something hidden that actually moves us. But you know, I'm open to this idea. Clearly open enough to dedicate a decade of my life writing about it. So clearly I'm not unopen.
So we're in a Beit Midrash, as you pointed out, and I thought you and I would engage for a few minutes in some
yeah,
study.
I think all of us should engage. Why you and I? What is this? They all stood in Sinai. Remember? Who doesn't? Yeah. So we had Kiddush, though.
So, as they make their way around, I'll just kind of set up what we're looking at. I just want to look because I think it will resonate with your larger project. This discussion at the very end of Masechet Menachot, it's one of the sources of the idea of study as a substitute for sacrifice. But there's a few different positions here that I think have some subtle differences and distinctions one from the other. And the source, the sugya, which is text number 2, picks up really... picks up with the end of the pasuk from Divrei Hayamim, Second Chronicles, chapter 2, verse 3, in which the temple is spoken of by Shlomo HaMelech, by King Solomon, as Le'olam Zot Al Yisrael. This is Israel's duty forever. Mm-hmm. And the rabbis, of course, see that, well, what do you mean by forever? We're living in the aftermath of its destruction. So how could you have used the word Le'olam? Yeah. And here we have, so we're jumping to the Talmudic passage on source number two, Le'olam Zot Al Yisrael, that's the quote from Divrei Hayamim. Amar Rav Gidel, Amar Rav, Zem Mizbeach Banui U'Michael Sar HaGadol Omed U'Makriv Alav Korban. So this is kind of a heavenly temple in which the angels are continuing to offer sacrifices. In other words, the earthly temple was destroyed, but there's a heavenly temple.
Yeah.
But here's where we see the study piece, and I think this relates to words in place of sacrifice, yes. In which we could, yes, say your whole project is this. Rabbi Yochanan Amar, Elu Talmidei Chachamim Ha'oskim Behilchot Avodah. These are the students who engage in studying the laws of sacrifice. Ma'ale aleihem hakatuv ki'ilu nivne mikdash bimehem. It is accounted to them, ma'ale aleihem, the verse is accounted to them as if, ki'ilu nivne mikdash bimehem, as if the temple, the sanctuary, is built in their days. So here we have this first position of Rabbi Yochanan, is when you study the laws of sacrifices, it's as if you're offering the sacrifice. Yeah. But then we have some interesting variant positions here that at first read, it sounds like they're kind of saying the same thing, but I want us to pay attention to the differences. Amar Reish Lakish, my dichtiv, and that's a typo in the Hebrew, Zot HaTorah Le'ola Le'mincha, Lechatat ula asham, kol haosek betorah ki'ilu hikriv ola mincha chatat va'asham. So Reish Lakish says, what's meant by the verse? This is the Torah, this is the teaching of the burnt offering, the meal offering, the sin offering, the guilt offering. In other words, why does it introduce it? Why does it introduce it with the word Torah, the teaching of? Because anybody who engages in the study of Torah, it is as if they have sacrificed. And here, again, we have ki'ilu hikriv ola mincha chatat v'asham. This is a different position because this says you don't have to be studying the laws of sacrifice. Yes. Any study of Torah,
yes,
is the equivalent of these sacrifices. Yeah. And then we have a third position with one more change, and then I'd love your commentary and your commentary. Amar Rava, hai li'ola limincha, Ola umincha mi ba'ale. Why do we have this preposition lamed before each of these? It would have, the verse could have just said ola umincha. Why the lamed hashimush? I think that's what it's called, right?
Yeah.
Is that what it's called in grammar? The two.
I was playing hooky when I studied grammar.
Okay. Ela amar Rava, kol haosek b'Torah eino tzarich. Lo ola, in other words, the le ola is lo ola velo chatat velo mincha velo asham.
Yeah.
Rava says the reason that the lamed for occurs before each word that teaches you that when you study Torah, you don't need any of these. Now, my own read, and I really want to hear yours. My own read of that subtle difference between Reish Lakish and Rava is maybe the difference between substitution versus replacement.
Mm.
That for both Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish, the study of Torah is a substitution for the sacrifices. But the idea of sacrifice is still very much alive, and we know that when we're studying laws about sacrifice, it's the equivalent of the sacrifice, or when we're just studying Torah at all, it's the equivalent of the sacrifice. But then comes this bolder statement of Rava that says, no, don't forget about the lamets. We don't need any of these sacrifices in a world in which we have Torah.
Yeah.
First of all, thank you. This is a fascinating text. I agree with you that the Rava text reads more radical than Resh Lakish. And I think the use of the word lo is very strong. Because Resh Lakish keeps it, as you know, you may consider this as that. But to actually negate, to use the word lo in context of the Korbanot is radical.
And with each
and
one,
it's bold,
right?
Yes.
Lo olav, lo mincha.
Now, I don't know what was in his mind. It may be a rhetorical, you know, shtick, because, you know, it doesn't, it may or may not be as radical as we think it is. But I'll tell you something interesting. Why go there for radical? Go to the prophets. And I told you, in Isaiah, that's how we start the Torah reading of Yom Kippur, right, where Isaiah says, take your korbanot. I don't need them. Why are you disrupting my yard? Go. Did I ask you? And in another place, I forget where it is, olotechem sefu al zivchechem veichlu basar. He's like, take the smoked offerings and just put it together with the zevach. Eat it. Eat meat. You need it. You look thin.
And Yirmiyahu asking, like, when did I ever command you
regarding? So there are very bold statements in the, like, anthems of prophecy that already say, Bet HaMikdash and Zevach and Korbanot are, you know, lo olah ve'lo mincha. And, like, suddenly when it comes from a rabbi, it feels very radical. But it's there. So this conflict has been there much earlier.
Is it ambivalence?
I think yes. And I think, look, let's be honest with ourselves. There's something very strange about the idea of korbanot and mikdash, and most of all, kruvim in the mikdash, the cherubims, as they were translated by the King James Version. And between monotheism, as we were led, you know, by our post-Maimonidean Hebrew school teachers to believe in or not believe in, right? I mean, what does all this have to do with the pure monotheism of Moses? And so, to begin with, yes, the answer is yes, absolutely. There is ambivalence, some bafflement, and a sense of contradiction, oxymoronic. There's something oxymoronic about sacrifices and pure monotheism. What, you're going to feed a god? You're going to smoke something and speak about it as reach nichoach, pleasing smell? What, as if God smells your meat, roasting meat, and that feeds the godhead? It's a strange thing. And therefore, the conflict is there from the beginning. And at the same time, there is something that bothers me in more modern versions of Judaism. And you hear this a lot, where people say, oh, the rabbis were actually very happy. They were pleased with the temple going away. I remember I spoke in front of a group, and some people who were clearly, you know, they were Yarmulke, they were, and they said, well, we thought that it's a good thing. We thought that we just grew out of. So in this mind, they made the destruction of the temple the biggest disaster that happened to our nation. That is like, I don't want to say
evolution.
The Holocaust. Yeah, the Holocaust pales in comparison, because the Holocaust does not pale in comparison to anything. But this was no smaller than the Holocaust. This was a terrible thing happening to the nation and to the religion and to the self-perception of people, and the destruction of the temple was a huge trauma. And I think that when people try to recreate the rabbis as reformed rabbis from the 19th century who want to modernize Judaism and put that demon of the temple aside, which they did, and only much later this was returned to some of the Siddurim,
The Talmudic rabbis, I don't think, were engaged in this project. Mm. I think they wanted to preserve the memory of the temple, and I think they are trying to continue being Jewish in spite of the fact that what was until a minute ago, historically, the basis for the religion vanished.
And what do you make of the Ki'ilu? That these are the equivalent of
I think it is, given the fact that we do not have the real thing, this may serve as a substitute. Hmm. And we, look, when we, no one is more in love and in awe than me with this wonderful cathedral of worlds, this world of words that we have built as our civilization. I love these texts. I live in this house of words. I build it. It's my mikdash. It is my personal temple, the Jewish literature. It's my temple, Jewish and Hebrew literature. But we always have to remember that it is a mere substitute. And in some ways, it's a scar tissue over the wound of the destruction that will never heal. Mm. And all of that, the crookedness, the pain, the neurosis, what you call the neurosis of Jewish existence, with all its many, including the great overreaction that is Zionism, which is a huge overreaction to this kind of crookedness, it all stems from the destruction of the Second Temple. It starts with the destruction of the first. And it's also not only that the house was destroyed, home was destroyed. When you say the word bayit in Hebrew, you mean house and home. That's very important. That's why I said these things are probably better understood in Hebrew. Habayit necherav. Home was destroyed. There was home. As a child, you say, you want to come to my house to play? My home, my house. My house was destroyed. There's nowhere to go back to. And also what happened is that the Jews were not only expelled from their land, where they became unwanted guests, vagabonds, you know, in everywhere they went, but also a great sense of falling from grace with God. And I don't think we understand how deep this trauma was. Falling from the grace of God. From being the chosen ones to become the loathsome vagabonds. And God does not intervene for you. The beloved child, the favored child, becomes a dirty, ugly vagabond. When I say the word ugly, I also want to add one more thing, because I deal a lot with aesthetics. Jews often refer to themselves as ugly. Think about it. Okay? Again, Woody Allen. Everywhere, Jews speak of themselves as ugly. Why? Because they look at themselves from the eyes of the majorities through which they live. They see themselves as different, as semi-human. A lot of self-hatred, a lot of self-loathing. If you read the Talmud and the Bible, the ancient Jewish text regards Jews as the most beautiful people in the world. Nachon? The children of Israel, that their beauty would pale the sun. Machim et ha-shemesh be-yofiyam. From the most beautiful nation that is deeply rooted in the land and enjoys the grace of God and assumes responsibility for the whole world to atone and maintain the world for all of humanity, we became poor, powerless, ugly vagabonds. Mm. Unwanted wherever we go, like Cain. Mm-hmm. Monsters, unwanted freaks. That's a terrible trauma. Terrible trauma. And then we made a lot of wonderful things with this pain, with this humiliation. We wove a beautiful culture, civilization, maybe to cover this pain and this self-loathing and the sense of unwantedness. But it is scar tissue. It is marvelously beautiful scar tissue. And there's no resolution for this. There's no resolution. We have to live with this strange, haunting duality that our culture, that we love and cherish and are hell-bent on preserving, is scar tissue.
I want to ask you two more questions, and then we'll open it up. This work is neither classically a religious work, nor is it secular. And true. I imagine this is somewhat indicative of you. And
he knows me too well.
And this middle place seems like vitally important to this moment.
Yes.
Here and there. And yes. I wanted you to say a few words about that.
Yeah. You know something? I am betwixt and between, but always was. And I attribute some of it to my background, because my family, both my parents are immigrants from Iran to Israel in different times. And like many of the Mizrahi or Sephardi families, we are not Sephardi, we're Mizrahi or we're Persian, we were traditional, which means that it was not... I never studied in a religious school. I never spent a day of my life in a yeshiva. Talmud and Mishnah and Midrash are late and cherished discovery of mine that I self-taught and a project of a labor of love and joy, but not something I was trained in. But it was also not this complete distance and indifference laced with disdain that my secular friends had towards all things Jewish. And I was very different because I was not raised in a neighborhood where it was mostly kind of a Masorati, traditional. Actually, we were the only Masorati family. All my friends were totally secular. I was raised right here in Rehov Chernyakhovsky. And Jerusalem of my childhood was much more secular than it is right now. Much, much more. The Teddy College Jerusalem. And so for me, this place of betwixt and between is where I am. That's where I live, and I always have, ever since I remember myself. Even, with my siblings, I mean, I was the one who was always drawn to the Jewy stuff. My siblings were not. They didn't care. And we didn't have any Sifrei Kodesh. We hardly had books at home. We weren't like a reading family. I was obsessed with books. So a lot of it is me being comfortable in this undefined territory. But, you know, Masortiut, as I grew up with it, had to vanish because it was a middle stage of secularization. You know, but now I feel a rise of this again, but from a more intellectually and culturally responsible place, where we say, we actually think that this is the right way to be Jewish. I think that those who are very religious or those who are totally secular are missing out on something. Those who are super religious do not separate themselves from the world. We are put on this earth as Jews to bring blessing into the world. If we disengage with the world, we have betrayed Abraham's calling, the Abrahamic promise. And if we're totally secular, then we cease to be Jewish. And I think also there's a more joyful, creative, aesthetic. Aesthetics are very important, very, very important to identity, for a healthy identity. People don't understand aesthetic, the importance of aesthetic. Jews especially have an issue downplaying the role of aesthetics. Masortiut is a very aesthetic movement. I'm a big believer in it, and I would like to see a strong, vital traditionalist movement that says the third way is actually the way. By the way, historically, most of the Jews, through most of history, were Masortim. very few Jewish were frum and like went to rabbis and asked unnecessary questions and caused the chumrot that then became. And very few didn't care. Most Jews lived in this wonderful space betwixt and between and had a relationship with the world, but had very warm and Jewish sentiments and a strong sense of commitment. I see it actually as the real way of being Jewish, and the side categories as forms of corruption. That's how I view things.
I wanted to ask you about this issue of translation. Your book was translated, as I mentioned at the beginning, by Hillel Halkin, and I'll just mention
the great Hillel
copies of the paperback available for sale afterwards by Michael Pomerantz in the lobby. But this translation of Hillel Halkin's was really the second translation, because you wrote a novel in Hebrew.
Did I tell you that, or it's an open secret?
I think it's you wrote a novel in Hebrew that takes place on the Upper West Side.
There
was another translation, okay. But I mean more metaphorically. You write a novel in Hebrew that is about American Jews on the Upper West Side. Yeah. And you kind of translated the American Jewish secular intellectual experience into Hebrew for Israelis.
Yeah, it was, I would say it's unprecedented, but there were some Hebraists in New York writing in the 20s. I was not aware of them until much later. So there were some precedents. I can't say that they were amazing literature. There was some good literature. But there was some, but it is not in the modern Hebrew literature as we know it today. This was radical, and also the fact that there were very little mention of Israel in the novel, and the little mention of Israel was kind of, not necessarily very embracing. Not anti-Israel. I'm a very big Israeli patriot, in spite of the fact it's getting harder and harder with every passing year, but it's I'm a very pro-Israel, not post-Zionist, not anti-Zionist, it was very exciting actually to write New York and America in Hebrew. You felt the novelty of it as I was writing. I felt that I'm putting my hands in unfamiliar matter. It's different texture, it's different, and it's wonderful. And there's places where it was a little clumsy in a good way, and places where I think it worked. The problem was that when I finished the novel, the Hebrew's original is a book about the Hebrew as much as it is a book about everything else. It's a discussion of the Hebrew. And then some of the people that loved the book most said, this could never be translated to English, right? Like, thanks. But I knew it could be, because I heard it also in English. I heard the narrating voice in English. I could distinguish it. It was there. I could discern it. And then when it was time to translate it to English, it was very difficult to find a right translator. As a matter of fact, there was one translation, so here's the secret behind it, that was good enough to get me the contract with HarperCollins, but not good enough to actually represent the novel in the world. And then there was a long and very colorful courtship period with the great Hillel Halkin, who is... Does anyone know Hillel? He is a wonderful man with a lot of personality. I love to say that he is the only man in the world who could do this book. He has big enough a Hebrew, big enough an English, and big enough an ego to take this book on. And then once he said yes, which was, again, the second hardest courtship of my life, second only to Dear Carolyn, it was wonderful, similarly. It was just a wonderful relationship with him. And we spent hours on the phone. Hillel was born on 106th and West End, 105th and West End, and I live on 101st and Riverside. So Manhattanites here, you know, it's a 4-minute walk, 5-minute walk, depends how fast you walk. And he now lives in Zichron Yaakov, and I live on Riverside Drive. So we would spend hours on the phone. He's the child, son of the Upper West Side. I'm a Yerushalmi. We switch places, and we would argue over, you know, all kinds of details of translation, such as, you know, Christmas trees. So what trees are they? I said, I don't know, Christmas trees. Do I know? I'm from Yerushalayim, do I know? He's like, yeah, but would you say they're spruces or hemlocks? I'm like, can't you say tree? Tree. Etz, min etz, as poor Alan Mintz used to say. Min etz, do I know? I said, write evergreen, okay? And he said, okay, fine. I'll write evergreen once, but don't get used to it. Like, don't become. Another anecdote that I love to tell is the shades of gray. Look, we live, Hebrew is a language that was not forged in gray surroundings. It was forged in other surroundings. I'm trying in a very detailed, very visual novel to pin down a certain hue of gray, shade of gray. And we would argue, is it more like graphite? Can you say graffitish, graphite-y? In Hebrew, you know, you could say ofalti. It's like, so it was wonderful to re-render the novel into the language that it was supposed to be written in, but it wasn't. Mm. But also to part with certain layers of the Hebrew that served the conversation about Hebrew, but did not belong in the novel. Mm. So that too was a very interesting, it was fascinating process. Mm. And to add to all of this, and this is about the alchemy and magic almost of translation and language, the French edition of the novel was translated from the English. Hmm. And I was horrified in the beginning. I said, what? What are you talking about? So, no, we chose a translator, that's it. I was in a position to argue. They bought the novel. They paid handsomely for it. I mean, they were very excited. And, you know, I went to France last July for a round of interviews. It was wonderful. And the interviewers, one after the other, sat and asked me the most intelligent and subtle and nuanced questions. So I really realized that it passed. It managed to ride that the Hebrew that was written in America, then translated in Israel into English, then traveled to France and was rendered into French, and the essence traveled. Because by their questions, I could see that they fully got it. Fully, 100%. The Le Monde, and they had wonderful things to say, and very subtle, very, very subtle, nuanced understanding of the work. So that further enhanced my belief in the magic power of words and the fact that there's a certain telepathic layer of language that we don't give a lot of credit to, but it's there. Mm-hmm. That it managed to do that.
Let's take a few questions, please. We'll just repeat the question for the recording. Either as a way of speaking to Ruby.
Thank you. I have 10 questions, but to try to focus, title about the sensuousness. I see the creativity. I see the meaning. And I see the physicality of the blood, of the slaughtering, and so on. Yeah. And just to relate it to this discussion, whether it's a recognition or a substitute or a replacement, learning the Torah, and how much you love learning the Torah, it doesn't have the same degree of sensuousness, certainly, or physicality. But I wonder if you could elaborate on your choice of the word sensuous.
Yeah, okay. Look, we use the word sensuous often as interchangeably with sexual nowadays. But it's not necessary, you know. There's sensuousness
is not just sexuality. There's a lot. There's all things aesthetic, all things that work on your body, not just the cerebral. So if for me, sensuous is the other side of cerebral, not necessarily. I don't think carnal and cerebral. I think corporeal and cerebral. I think sensuous and cerebral. But I want to actually talk about the erotic tension in the temple. The temple had great erotic tension, and that's something that, thank you for this question, because it enables me to touch on this. Especially the first temple, the cherubim. Look, there's a wonderful and really strange Talmudic tale about the cherubim, the cherubims, who were these two winged, very problematic in every way, two winged creatures that definitely had a certain human aspect, like anthropomorphic aspect, that were made of gold and that were seated on the Aron, on the Ark of Covenant. And the Kuvim, according to one of the legends of the Talmud, one of the versions, were placed on the Ark of Covenant, me'urin ze bezeh kederech zachar v'negeva, basically as if they are in the middle of sexual intercourse. So there was a...
We usually say an embrace when we teach that. So yeah, but okay.
You should maybe rethink that and say me'urin ze bezeh, it's not embrace. It's a very strong term. And having sex on the Aron. Fascinating, amazing, shocking, wonderful, irreverent, everything. The worst part of the story is that, first of all, there's a whole discussion about how they would show it. They would show it to the people once a year when everybody would be assembled, and they would show it and say, you see this very sexual image? Take it with you when you think about your relationship with God. Okay? Your relationship with God and Knesset Israel kechibat zachar v'nekeva. So learn to think about your religious experience with the same fireness of your erotic experience. Amazing, right? And then there's a whole conversation about how long do you keep the curtains open? Because it is a very, very dangerous thing to do, to start showing pornographic, erotic images. Again, in a world where there are no images, you see two celestial creatures having sex for 5 seconds, and then the priest quickly closed the curtain. It is a very stirring in a world where you're not bombarded with images. You hardly see any graven image ever. But then when the temple was destroyed, according to one of the stories of the Talmud, the those who ransacked it, Babylonians, because it's the first temple, took the Aron out and put it in the marketplace and showed everyone it and said, look, this lewdness is what Jews call holy. So taken out of the context of the holy, it became a pornography. The Kohanim were very sexy young men. We think of like, oh, rabbis, none of that. Most of the Kohanim were not so holy. They were representatives of the rich clans of Jerusalem that paid huge amount of money and quarreled and bribed, and there were a lot of intrigues about who's going to get the Kohen Gadol this year. Once they had it, they chose the most strong. First of all, you have to be very strong to be Kohen Gadol. You do a lot of butchering, a lot of hacking of big chunks of meat. It's very hard work. Number two is that you have to look beautiful. You have to be a perfect specimen of the human species, like all the animals that are sacrificed have to be perfect specimen. It's all about the aesthetics. Yeah, of the best of the best. They have to be very beautiful. Like, you have to be as beautiful as possible. Actually, there's a
Mane Hadar.
And it's in the Yerushalmi, it actually says, Kohen Gadol Shegadol Me'echav Be'osher Chochma Koach Noi V'Mar'e. Two words for looks. He has to be beautiful, and he has to also just, He has to dress well. He has to look good. That's part of it. And there are wonderful stories about some kohanim that wore such thin, beautiful material because they were rich and they wanted to show off that they looked naked. And there's like a whole... It was a place with great erotic tension. And I think we should connect to this and understand the fieriness of this experience as part of the deep structure of religion. And again, the Hasidic masters knew that. The Hasidic masters and the Kabbalists told us that if you want to engage in mystical pursuit, you have to harness your erotic energy. It's something that Rav Cordovero said. I'm sorry, I'm lecturing. Sorry.
No, it's great. I just want to make Reuven, I just want to give some other people a chance as well.
Sorry. I get excited, Matamut. I really love this.
I'm interested in the process whereby you get an idea in your head. You wake up in the morning, or maybe you thought about it, and it gets translated to a novel like that. I mean, I know it's potentially a very big question to ask you, but if you could you give us some idea how that works?
Yeah. Look, it's kind of a mystery to me too. There's a certain alchemy here that I'm. It's going to sound like a terrible cliche, and I'm going to sound like I'm trying to sound cute, but it's not. It's really it. I don't have full control over the process. There's bigger forces, like in the mind, the back of the mind, all kinds of places, not always revealed to me. I know, as I said before, that there are a lot of ideas. You get a lot of ideas. And I even sometimes hesitate to use the word idea because idea makes it sound a little formed and verbal, and sometimes it's a gesture. There's a certain gesture, like you can hardly catch it in words, even in your mind, but it's nagging at you. It's a certain composition, a certain sound of a sentence, a certain voice that narrates the work. Really, it's like you hear things. And most of these ideas come and go, like shooting stars. Very few actually get embed themselves on the mind. And of those who embed themselves, also few come to fruition. And then there's so many ways of a process. I once heard David Grossman speak, and he said something that sounded very interesting. He said, I never know what's going to happen in the next page, because if I knew, I would get bored and I would stop writing. And everybody smiled, it sounds great. And I was thinking, I said, oh, that's so nice. This is so not who I am. I'm so not David Grossman. I know exactly what I want. I capture the gesture, so I usually write the first and last paragraph of every work I do. And that way I kind of catch it. I'm a big control freak, very OCD. And then I need it to be a very, very, very precise arc. And they're usually kind of strange angled arcs. And then I work very, very hard to capture this arc and build it. When I studied a while ago about the building of the Mishkan, I was thinking that it's actually a very good way of describing the process, you know. That there was a vision that Moses saw on the mountain, and then he had to translate it into an earthly vision. So it's pretty much like that. And it's a lot of very, very hard work. A lot of hard work.
You may not want to answer this. I don't know how artists feel about this, but what's next?
I was pretty much not writing in the past few years. I was running around with the various translations. I'm grateful because the novel's success was very exciting, and it took me to many places, and I gave hundreds of talks and was flown to a million places and then Europe and then here and then, so it was there was a lot of engagement around it, and I think I used it also to just distance myself because this was a traumatic process. It was so detailed, the arc was so big, the work was so demanding that I really needed a long break. It's not wonderful for my career that I vanished from, but I'm still around. People hear about me a lot. So I was thinking of starting a new novel, And then I shuddered at the thought, and I'm now working on a collection of short stories, Hebrew stories with a strong American theme. For the first time in my life, I'm drawn to some characters of Israelis living abroad, and that kind of that silent tragedy of this existence. And I hope to be done with it soon and publish it, and then I promise a great Jewish novel that's about a fifth of this in length.
Last question, Yonatan.
Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
I want to say one or two things before I ask my question. I grew up in a similar fashion. I was in and out Haredi with one parent, and then after the divorce, my mom is Masorti, and so I was in both sides. Coming to Pardes and pushing myself, like you said, learning Midrash and Talmud, it's all been on my own push. And I mean, being in this room, hearing you speak, it's full circle, because I'm leaving very soon, unfortunately. I recently learned about the Korbanot. Not recently, when I got here, Tefillah, for me, the Korbanot has been the biggest thing. Three times a day, according to the Ben Ish Chai, we say Korbanot. We say Ketoret. In the morning, Korbanot begins with V'tit Palel Chana, the offering of a child to the service of the temple. So to hear you speak, it's really Mamash doing beautiful things for me. My question is, how do you engage with halakha? If you're writing with the Talmud, if you're engaged through the conservative...
I don't engage with halakha. It's not my thing. I'm not a halakha. I mean, I am traditional. For example, I would never write on Shabbat. I don't work on Shabbat. But I do not engage in halakha. It's not my thing. It's not... I'm big on Minhag Yisrael. I am a practicing Jew in my way. I am. But it's not Orthodox. And halakha for me is a source of artistic inspiration. Agadah, I must say, I'm much more of a sucker for Agadah than halakha. And I do not engage in halakha so much myself. And I also want to say something, that there's a certain myth, okay, that halakha is the base of Jewish life. It is not. It never has been. Halakha is the, if you go to the university and you see like the library of the school of law school, and you want to open the law and get an idea about life, it's an aspect of life. And the reason why we think about halakha as the base is because it's until very recently, when I say recently, I'm saying a few hundred years ago, the only text that survived widely, were widely circulated, were the texts of the rabbinic sect, which is a very small, very responsible and great intellectual elite. But most Jews had minhagim, and had traditions, and lived on all kinds of negotiations with Jewish life, and it was a big continuum from everywhere and from all the time, from the days of the temple and before that until modern age. Halakha never was the organizing a factor in Jewish life. And this is something we need to remember. I'm not saying it to disrespect halakha. I have great respect for it. It just has to be acknowledged that this is not the base for Jewish life. But I will continue and say, but people had many more minhagim. So there was Jewish life, and there was many do's and don'ts. And in some ways, because the minhagim were lost and the do's and don'ts, people don't know them anymore, halakha became more powerful paradoxically in modern time. So it kind of replaces the minhag. But I personally do not engage in halakha. I don't have anything against it, but I don't let it rule my Jewish life.
Ruby, I want to thank you for the gift of your words, and the gift of your words here, and the gift of your words tonight. And thank you so much for being with us. Thank you, everyone, for coming. Erev Tov.
Thank you for downloading this podcast from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more online content, please visit lmod.pardes.org.